Okay, so we are just doing this practice today, and you've taken some time out of your busy lives to do this for a day, and that's not easy. Seems to be harder every year for people. It'll be hard for me too, but it's my job, so... Because we have more and more demands, so we really have to. It really has to be meaningful to us, or we wouldn't do it. Which is the lead-in to what I want to talk about today, which is the statement from the 9th century in China, which gets talked about quite a bit in Zen circles. What is the meaning of Bodhidharmas coming from the West? What is the meaning of Bodhidharmas coming from the West? So, we need meaning in our lives. And as people, some people know, I have some experience with homeless people, and people who live outside often tend not to have much meaning in their lives, not to have any meaning in their lives. Their lives are defined by where are they going to get their next meal? How are they going to stay dry? How are they going to... is the library going to be open when the rain unexpectedly comes? Hopefully it will be, but if it closed down when the rain comes, where are they going to go? Do they have their sleeping bag dry? Can they borrow someone else's? So when people who've been living outside for a long time move inside, my experience has been that they are first very disoriented because they've lost their purpose. Their purpose was always the next 2 hours. How am I going to get a meal? How am I going to stay dry? And now all of a sudden they're inside. And they have no purpose. So we thought, we started bringing people inside, people that I work with, that there'd be lots of big problems, like their mental illness, or their chemical dependency. Oh, well, those are problems. But the main problem is that they're totally disoriented because they have no purpose. Human beings are purposeful. And then we have to say to them, well, maybe you can begin to have a purpose beyond the next hour. Maybe you can begin to think about the next few days or the next week or develop a vision for the future. And it takes a long time, but it's certainly worth it. Certainly worth it. So, what is the meaning of Bodhidharmas coming to the West? Having meaning is important to us as human beings. Meaning. Viktor Frankl, in Man's Search for Meaning, talks about the time he spent in concentration camps when the only way that he could survive was to visualize a future, and to really visualize it, to really think about it, because he would have just been entirely wiped out and given up if he hadn't been able to see a future of meaning for himself, see what he really wanted to do, right in the middle of that awful situation, go inside and see what his inmost desire was to do. And then later, after the war was over, some of you know Viktor Frankl. He studied people, Holocaust people, and the most survivors who were doing the best were the ones who had gone inside and thought about what they really wanted to do afterwards, and created a life inside afterwards for them. And those are the ones who had done the best. So we as human beings need meaning. We all do. And some of our meaning comes from our personal mythology. That's what happens in our families, what we learned, and what values were passed on to us. And even in dysfunctional families, and you know all families are dysfunctional, so the word dysfunction doesn't really mean anything. Because all families are just families. There are things that were passed on, values. I think the fact that you were doing Zen practice means that something resonated in you about courageously going inside, courageously looking at yourself from your own family, whether you know it or not. Partly. I think for each of us it's different, but we all have our own stories. And usually those stories that were passed down from our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, there's some courage, or there's some doing something really significant, something really meaningful. So that's the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West, is what we're doing today, sitting quietly, doing nothing, so that we can discover the Buddha nature. A Bodhidharma is very well known for saying, no dependence on words and letters. Direct pointing to the heart mind. Direct pointing to the heart mind. Seeing into your nature and attaining Buddhahood. But there's nothing to attain. All you'd have to do is see, and then you are immersed in life. So that story then passed on, right? Passed on. That value, that meaning, that we can all discover Buddha nature through this sitting practice. Maybe we don't have to do it for 9 years straight like he did. But I'll tell you, you have to do it for quite a bit of time. You have to do it for quite a bit of time. I don't know how long. But 9 hours is pretty good. 9 hours, 9 years, 9 days, 9 months. 9 hours is pretty good. If you completely do 9 hours, that's 9 years. You won't know the difference. You won't know the difference. That's the meaning of this practice for us. So that we can see into our own natures. See into the nature of the universe, which is not out there, which is right here. See it. And be completely composed and at ease when we see it. Oh, what a relief. All that stuff I was trying to do. Well, I can keep doing that if I really want to. But unnecessary. Unnecessary. So, our teacher, Katagiri Roshi, pictured there, Suzuki Roshi, Dogen before him. They really, all three of those guys went across oceans to show people Buddha nature, to help people discover Buddha nature. They went across oceans. And as you know, Suzuki Roshi wanted to do it when he was 21, and he finally got to do it when he was 55. His aspiration, his vision, never gave up. And Katagiri Roshi, when he had cancer, and I hadn't seen him for a long time, and I went to see him in the hospital, and he said, there are two fascicles on Dogen. He was really sick, and his wife was there. Two fascicles on Dogen. I really want to show people, because I think if they digest these chapters, they'll see their Buddha nature. Well, then he died. I mean, I don't know how long it was. I think that was a couple months later that he died. But that aspiration, to keep that aspiration alive, is what humanness is all about. I mean, if it's a noble aspiration, and who can say Buddha nature is not noble? Then you help all beings at the same time. You just do. So that's the story that I'm passing on to you, but I don't know if I'm passing it on. It just got passed on to me. Like my grandmother used to tell me stories about my, you know, whoever, great-great-grandfather. Oh, that's wonderful. That inspired me. It still does. And then, of course, when we do zazen like this, sometimes our aspiration gets a little weak. Probably your aspiration hasn't gotten weak yet. It's only 10:15. Oh, maybe it has. I don't know. But your aspiration gets a little weak, and you begin to think about, oh, God, this is Saturday. You know, and how many things I was supposed to get done by Sunday night? How many things people are depending on me? How many projects are really important? And that stuff all comes in, right? That you know you want to leave your attaché case at the door, but then you can't get along without it. Your attachment case, right? Your attaché case. But you can get along without it. You can get along without it. And sometimes your aspiration will go. And then when your aspiration goes, what happens is the more negative stories come in. Right? Because we also, there are also negative stories from our tradition, from our family, from our life. The negative stories from our family are our own negative stories. And Buddhism has its negative stories too, because Buddhists are human beings. But you know, I don't inspire you by talking to you about the way in which women were put down for hundreds of years in Buddhism. I mean, that would not inspire you. But I shouldn't deny it. I shouldn't deny it. I don't inspire you by talking to you about the way kamikaze pilots in Japan said they were great Zen teachers. We can't deny it. We can't deny our shadow side. And that stuff comes up in zazen. Maybe that comes up not at 10 a.m., but at 3 p.m. Maybe it comes up at noon. I don't know. Who knows when it will come up? That is the beast, Bodhidharma as the beast. Beauty and the beast. You think Bodhidharma is a handsome guy when you look at him? Is he handsome? Is the beast handsome? Oh, the beast marries beauty, does it? Doesn't the beast marry beauty? Doesn't he? No separation, right? But oh, yucca. No separation. I'm out of here, man. Right? Or I wish I was out of here, but I promised. Or something like that. Well, then you promise. That's your aspiration. Even if it's just a little promise, you did. You promised yourself you would do this. You promised. Well, aspiration is good enough. So, there are a lot of answers to this question, as in all Zen. In all these Zen questions. But the two most famous answers are by Lin Chi Rinzai, Zen master. Whole Rinzai school comes out of him, right? And Zaosho, or Joshu, who I talked about last time, who had a tongue. He could touch his nose with his tongue. He was called the horse master. I don't know why he was called. I guess horses have a long tongue. I don't know. He was called the horse master. So, just those two answers I'll talk about a little bit. First is Lin Chi. Monk asked Lin Chi, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to the West? You get the West part, right? From India, West to China, right? And you know Bodhidharma is supposed to have had red hair and blue eyes. Chinese had never seen anybody with red hair and blue eyes before. And when I was in India, I sure didn't see it. Did you see anybody with red hair and blue eyes? Huh?
Did the Vikings get put in
<don't know. laughs> So what is the meaning of this red-haired, blue-eyed guy coming to China, disrupting things by sitting in a cave and telling us all to come sit with him, leave our responsibilities behind, and then growling at us about seeing into our own natures? What is the meaning of that? Lin Qi? What is the meaning of that, Lin Qi? And Lin Qi says, if Bodhidharma coming had any meaning, he could have not even saved himself. He could have not even saved himself. Well, what would you expect Lin Qi to say? So, our aspiration, we need our aspiration. Our aspiration is to climb, to commit ourselves to doing this whole 9 hours, 9 days, 9 years, commit ourselves. But then we also need to let go of it completely. Without our aspiration, we can't do anything. But if we cling to our aspiration, we start fighting with ourselves. Oh, my aspiration is different from hers. And my, I have the true aspiration. And her aspiration is kind of namby-pamby. Mine is better. Hers is kind of something or other. So, no aspiration. No aspiration. Free of aspiration. But you need aspiration to stay on the path. But at some point, you jump off the 100-foot ball. You just jump off. You don't jump off. It's just a release, a big release. Big release. Or a little release. It doesn't have to be a big, huge release. A little release. And you're beyond the duality of meaning and not meaning. But that's not meaninglessness in the sense that Viktor Frankl found these people. That's beyond meaning. And then you can go back and use meaning when you need it, but you're not caught by it anymore. You're not proselytizing to yourself. And we say we don't proselytize, but actually, you do have to proselytize a little bit to yourself to get yourself to stay for a whole retreat. Maybe not for one day. Maybe not for 2 days. Depends on who you are. But for 7 days, a lot of people have to do a lot of internal proselytizing, right? Well, that's okay. That's got your aspiration. But be gentle, be kind. An aspiration is just an aspiration. It's nothing in particular. And if you turn it into a religion, then we're fighting about whose way is best. Then clouds and water and Zen Center and Dharma fields, we're all get our little armies. And who knows? It happened. It happened. It hasn't. We haven't gathered up arms here in the Twin Cities yet, but it happened historically. Because of my aspiration, my lineage, my whatever. So, no meaning. No meaning. But meaning. What meaning? Meaning as a taking off point for no meaning. You need meaning first to take off so that you can go beyond meaning. Then you come back to meaning. But when you come back to meaning, then it's just meaning as meeting, as encountering, rather than as meaning that you have to cling to define yourself, because you're defined by drinking a glass of water. A glass of water, a blue glass of water with plastic glass, it's half full. That's your self-definition. Isn't that what Dogen said? Well, he never talked about blue plastic glasses of water. So when I was first studying Zen in San Francisco, there was a group, and I think I'll just name the group. I think it's okay. It was Soka Gakkai Buddhists who were after me. Well, they knew I was interested in Buddhism, but I didn't know anything about them. But they were doing at that time in San Francisco, very strong fundamentalist Buddhism. You can get saved by out recruiting people all the time, recruiting people, telling us if we repeated this, we would get saved and we would be enlightened. They were quite aggressive. And one night I was having dinner. Maybe can't imagine that I was cooking. Probably my roommates were cooking. And I was probably setting the table. I can set the table pretty well. And we had these two Zen priests over for dinner, Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi. They were both. Before the dinner started, there was a knock on the door. And I came down, and it was these Soka Gakkai guys again. They'd seen me. And they said, we wanted to talk to you again about reciting Buddha's name. If you recite Buddha's name, you can be really wealthy. And I said, well, I told you, I'm not interested in being wealthy. And they said, no, we mean spiritual wealth. We mean spiritual composure. I said, well, gee, I've got a couple of Buddhist priests with me right now, so this is not a good time. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, and they left. They were a little bit, ooh. And so I went in and I said, they asked me, Suzuki and Katagiri, who is at the door? And I said, oh, some Soka Gakkai people. And Suzuki Roshi looked kind of, you know, not very happy. And he said, I think they have a problem. So we develop a problem for ourselves when we cling to any special meaning about things. The meaning is always comes out of life. So it's not set. It comes out of the creation. It comes out of the process. It comes out of the engagement. And that meaning is not set. The meaning that's set is a meaning that bogs us down, that creates divisiveness internally, divisiveness externally. And in stillness, there meaning or no meaning. You can have it either way. Take it either way. That's why Lin Chi also said, if you meet a Buddha on the road, do what with him? Yeah. All right. Ooh. But of course, that's Rinzai. We don't do that kind of thing in Soto. We're good guys. Good guys and girls. Good ladies and gentlemen.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not at all sure. No, not at all sure. No, a beast. We're human beings. There's always the beast. So supposedly, when Buddha was with his first group of monks, and many of you know about this, they wanted to develop an attire that would somehow fit in and give them some meaning, that would fit into this caste system where the Brahmins were the highest and the most spiritual. Somehow it would fit in. But you know what Buddha did, right? He said, forget that. Let's sew these rags together, right? Let's sew these rags together and let's take them from the funeral pyres in which all the castes are mixed together, and even the untouchable, some of this cloth in the robe, although not in the raksu, because we don't have untouchables here, would be untouchable cloth. And there'd be no difference, no special meaning, no special sense that I'm being someone by doing this. And when there's no special meaning that we cling to, then there's just gentleness comes up, just gentleness comes up, because you don't have anything to prove. Nothing to prove in particular to yourself or to anyone. Okay, so that's Lin Chi's answer. Then we go to even the better known answer of Zhao Zhou, Joshu. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming to the West? Just spend a minute on that. I think that'll be long enough. So do you guys remember what's the meaning of what the most well-known story is? Well-known answer is by Joshu. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West? Anybody remember? Yes. The oak tree in the garden, although sometimes it is translated as the cypress tree in the courtyard, or the cypress tree in the garden, or the oak tree in the courtyard. I don't know Chinese. That's the meaning. So, that's what we're doing today. Stopping, looking, and listening, right? Very simple. Just like, remember, maybe you don't remember when I was in kindergarten. My mother told me when I cross the streets, stop, look, and listen. This is our practice. Stopping, looking, listening. If you stop, look, and listen, you're not going to run in front of a car. You're not going to run in front of a car. You're not going to hurt yourself. You're not going to hurt someone. And so Basho says, learn about the pine from the pine and about bamboo from the bamboo. That's what we're doing today. Learning about the pain in the legs from the pain in the legs. Learning about the rain outside from the rain outside. Learning about our breathing from our breathing. Learning about our boredom from our boredom. Don't get fancy. There's nothing fancy about this. So Basho says, learn about the pine from the pine, about the bamboo from the bamboo. The poet should detach his mind from self, says Basho, and enter into the object. If you stop, look, and listen, you enter in. Doors always open. Doors never close. It swings, so sometimes you think it's closed. But it never is really closed. Always enter in. Enter in. So, Zhao Shu, who said the oak tree in the garden to the monk who asked him, and we can imagine that there was, they were maybe looking out on an oak tree or something like that. He's the teacher who started practicing when he was 18 and had his first awakening when he was in his 20s and stayed with his teacher till his teacher died when he was 60. And then at 60 started teaching. So he really humbled himself from the time he was in his 20s to 60 and just learned about his own reactions, stopped, looked, and listened. So that finally, when he had a chance to be a teacher, he had seen so much of himself, so much of life without trying to fight with it, that he was able just to teach pretty well. And then he was a wandering teacher till he was 80, and then he finally sat down stayed in a monastery from 80 on. So when he was 80, from 80 on, he mostly sat in a chair. You didn't know they did that. Well, especially the teacher. I don't know if the students got to do that, but the teachers did it. Probably the students didn't get to. You know, it was pretty hierarchical. So he sat in a chair. And he had a beautiful chair, hand-carved chair. Of course, everything would be hand-carved, right? Beautiful hand-carved chair that he sat in. And the story goes that the hand-carved chair broke. So an arm broke in the handcart chair. And so instead of having the arm replaced, he put a branch up by it and sort of secured it with a branch and just let the splinters continue to stick out. So and his chair was covered with something, whatever they covered with chairs with. So in Dokusan with his students, until they caught on, whenever he thought they were too hypnotized by their thinking and they kept asking questions, he would pull up the thing of his chair, you know, this beautiful hand carved chair, and then they would see the splinters. And he would say, "This." That's the whole thing. That's the whole story. Then they would shut up for a little while. Or maybe they would have some, maybe they would really look at that splinter. Maybe they would really stop, look, and listen. And maybe when they did that, they would experience a wonderful clarity. Maybe so. Even for a moment, even for a half a moment. That stillness is your nature, and it's no nature at all, because it has no meaning, but it has all the meaning that you could want in anything, because it's free of meaning, completely free. And you know, since we're having a retreat, I'm not going to ask for questions. I just want to join you in going back to just inhabiting our moments together. Okay?